Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Are humans the enemy? Should pigs and peas have constitutional rights? Today on ID the Future, Joshua Yunkin discusses the new book and documentary film, The War on Humans, with the book's author, Discovery Institute Senior Fellow and bioethicist, Wesley J. Smith. Smith heads up Discovery's Center on Human Exceptionalism. This is the first in a series of podcasts featuring Smith discussing a range of issues from what it means to be human to radical animal rights to the growing movement to grant civil rights to animals and even plants. Be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com to get more information about the digital book and the documentary.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Joshua Yunkin. Today I have with me Wesley Smith. Wesley, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. If you wouldn't mind, for listeners, just sort of explain your book, what it's about, and who you are.
I'm Wesley Smith. I'm the head of the Center on Human Exceptionalism for the Discovery Institute, which we believe is a crucial issue coming in the 21st century. That is, what does it mean to be human? Is being human important in the world today? Do we have greater value than animals or even nature? These are issues that are under tremendous question in today's environmental movement, in the animal rights movement, in bioethics. And human exceptionalism isn't just about the unique value of human life. It also seeks to appeal to our unique capacity for human moral agency. We have duties. Only human beings in the known universe have duties. We have duties to the planet. We have duties to treat the environment correctly. We have duties to treat animals humanely. We have duties to each other. We have duties to our posterity. So the term human exceptionalism tries to get both sides of that coin, the unique value of human life and the unique obligations that we bear simply and merely because we're human.
That's interesting. So the duties that we have, that you say that they kind of flow from what we are.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And it's a little
who we are.
Who we are.
Yes.
Okay. And it's a little different from saying, well, what we have, what we owe other things and other people is just simply what the state says we owe. It comes from a source even deeper than that.
Yes, I think it does. And it comes from the essence of human nature. That is, we exhibit moral agency. We are moral beings. We are the only known true moral beings, again, in the known universe. Now, of course, what that morality is differs from society to society, and it is worked out through processes that involve rationality, which again is a unique human attribute. It involves emotions. It involves experience. It involves futurity, the idea of planning. It involves learning from the past. These are all uniquely human emotions, not, but uniquely human attributes from which we create the morality of society. And all human beings have this moral sense. Even evil human beings, why do we call them evil? Because they're human. We don't call a jackal that eats another animal alive evil because it's just being a jackal. If I did that, I would be evil. Why? Because I'm human.
You depart from your nature.
I've certainly departed from the better angels of my nature, to quote Lincoln. And so we as humans create right versus wrong. We have a sense of ought, O-U-G-H-T. Mm-hmm. And that is important. And the differences between humans and other life forms are moral differences, not biological differences. So sometimes I'll have people say to me, well, you know, you talk about human exceptionalism. That's arrogant and hubristic, which of course it isn't, since I'm saying, well, if being human isn't what gives us the obligation to treat animals properly, what does? Well, nobody has an answer to that. It's, of course, because we're human. But they'll say, well, look at the elephants. It's got an exceptional trunk, and the hawk has exceptional eyesight, and that's very true. But those are biological distinctions that don't have a moral meaning. The differences in human beings, they have a moral meaning, moral differences. We're bipedal. If we were the only bipedal species on the planet, that wouldn't matter because bipedalism is biological. It does not have a moral dimension to it. Thank you. But moral agency does. Rationality does. A sense of duty to the future does. The founding fathers of the United States talked about creating a society for their posterity. That's us. You don't have squirrels thinking, how can I create a better squirrel society for our posterity? Only humans do that. And I'm trying to have people, as we are at the Discovery Institute, understand that if you just reduce us, as there's so many trying to do, to another animal in the forest, all we are is another species among all the species on the earth. That's how we're going to act. We're not going to act better, as they posit. They say, well, if you see you're part of nature, then you'll be more gentler on the land. No. If you really self-define yourself as just another animal in the forest, you're going to act like any other animal in the forest, which is to get what you need for yourself. That's how animals act, or for your herd, or for your particular small family unit, like a mother bear protecting her cubs. But if you are human and you say, by golly, because I'm human, I have to make sure I don't turn Puget Sound into a cesspool, well, then you've done something different. An elephant wouldn't care less what happened to Puget Sound.
That's right. I'm reminded in your talk here by the NHRP, the Human Rights Project folks. They filed a petition, I think, in New York State.
You mean the Non-Human Rights Project?
The Non-Human Rights Project.
Right,
is a
yes.
Legal group, I think, who's filed
right.
on behalf of a couple of chimpanzees.
Well, here's what the Non-Human Rights Project is headed by an animal rights activist named Stephen Wise, and they are trying to get one judge. All it takes is one judge, and we've certainly seen that in society, just one judge who wants to make history. They're trying to get a judge to say that one animal has a human-type right, and then they believe the species barrier between humans and animals will collapse, and they've got a point, and then animals will get a whole broad variety of enforceable rights, which, of course, will be enforced by animal rights activists because it's really their agenda, not the animal's agenda. The animals are oblivious to all of this. Well, the Non-Human Rights Project filed three lawsuits in New York seeking to have various chimpanzees. One was at a roadside zoo. One was a research chimp at a university. One was kept in a private home. To have them declared a person and to be released on a writ of habeas corpus. Now, the only details we know were from the roadside zoo. And it appeared that the chimp in the roadside zoo, based on what the Non-Human Rights Project brief said, was being mistreated. Did they go to the animal welfare authority to say, hey, there's this chimp being mistreated? You've got to go in and raid that place and take that chimp to better care, which is a human duty. No, they allowed that chimp to stay in that level of mistreatment so they could have their little lawsuit. And they filed the lawsuit and they sought to have the chimps named as plaintiffs in the case. They lost that. One judge properly didn't even do anything but have a clerk's order dismissing because a chimp should not be able to bring a lawsuit. Two judges listened very carefully to the presentation, which had to do with the capacities of chimps, which, of course, they're very intelligent animals, and then finally dismissed. As far as I know, those chimps remain in, at least in one case, would appear to be abusive situations or neglectful situations. And nothing's been done about it because the Non-Human Rights Project, unless they've done something I'm not aware of, wasn't about protecting those individual animals from abuse or neglect. It was about trying to destroy human exceptionalism. That's their agenda. And they're going to file lawsuits in other states. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals filed a lawsuit on behalf of the orcas, the killer whales kept at SeaWorld in San Diego, trying to have a judge declare the animals to be slaves. The judge dismissed, but listen to the basis for the dismissal. He found quotes of what it means, definition, to be a slave, and it said, when one person has ownership of another person. So if you have a whale declared a person, then indeed those killer whales could become, quote, slaves. And the world as we know it would be altered forever. And human exceptionalism, which has brought us so much prosperity and freedom and brought so much compassion into the world, would begin to crumble. And that is the intent in animal rights. That is the intent in radical environmentalism. That is the intent in utilitarian bioethics that seeks to deny equal human dignity and the sanctity of human life based on capacities. And if the bioethicists get their way, these utilitarian bioethicists like Peter Singer, somebody like Terry Schiavo might be able to be farmed for her organs. So these are the stakes. Universal human rights are at stake. The intrinsic dignity of human life is at stake. The understanding of our unique place in the world, both in terms of value and in terms of obligation, they are at stake. This is the most important, I think, philosophical, ideological, and moral issue of our times. And frankly, it isn't getting enough attention. And that's why at the Discovery Institute, we have the Center on Human Exceptionalism, because we're trying to raise the visibility of this issue. The attackers of human exceptionalism are motivated, they're ideologically driven, and they're well-financed. Human exceptionalism is not getting as much of a defense as it requires, because people think it's a self-evident truth. They don't think anybody would really think that humans are just an animal in the forest. And there's a lot of complacency. That needs to change, and that's what we're trying to do at the Discovery Institute.
Part of the problem that I think that we face is we're sort of in the situation of the proverbial frog in the pot, where the changes are happening very gradually to the point where it's not noticed by the frog in the pot. But if you stand outside, then you see the situation. How would you overcome the complacency that you mentioned earlier about how we are towards the regime changing fundamentally?
I've used that metaphor myself, but I think that it's no longer a slow boil. I mean, look around you, the water's bubbling. Anyone who says it can't happen here has been unconscious for the last 50 years. Go back in time 50 years and see the things that have happened in this society, some of them good. Overcoming a lot of racism has been tremendously good. But the attitudes of this society that people said it'll never happen, it can't happen, it won't happen, and they've been wrong. In the Netherlands, euthanasia has now led to infanticide in that country, of babies born with disabilities and terminal illnesses. In Belgium, they've coupled euthanasia with organ harvesting. I first warned about that potential back in my first anti-euthanasia article in Newsweek magazine in 1993, called The Whispers of Strangers, if people want to look it up. And I warned that if this kept up, if the idea of assisted suicide and euthanasia began to be societally accepted, it would lead to taking people, killing them, and harvesting their organs. I was called an alarmist in 1993 when I wrote that. Here, 21 years later, it is being done in Belgium, and doctors in Belgium are bragging about it. They're holding symposia about it, and they're telling other doctors, look out for people who want to die, who have neuromuscular diseases like multiple sclerosis, because they have good organs. Now, in 1993, people said, oh, it can't happen here. It'll never happen here. That's like the Nazis, and I'm not making the Nazi analogy myself, but it's happening. So people can either pretend it's not happening, or they can say, good grief, it's happening. This is not good for me, my children, or my grandchildren. I have a duty to the future, and I'm going to engage. Or they can go watch football, or they can go watch Kim Kardashian. I wish I didn't know who she was. And just decide that other people will decide the future for them. I mean, we're free people, and we have the opportunity to either engage these issues, as hard and difficult as they might be, or we can just say, oh, well, whatever people do, they do. All I can do is hold up a mirror to what's happening in society. That's all we can do at the Discovery Institute and say, listen, this matters. This is really important. We hope you'll join us in trying to stand up for human exceptionalism.
That's the end of part one of this series of interviews with Wesley J. Smith, author of the new digital book, The War on Humans, and contributor to the new documentary film of the same name. For more about the book and the film, be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com. That's www.waronhumans.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.